The tunnel above was so low, Anya had to hunch over and waddle down its length. She went left at the first intersection, following a trail of food wrappers, an unfortunate sign that people had been this way. Fossils dotted the floor on one side of the passage, while the other was slick mud. The lantern, back in her hand again, revealed a rusty pick stuck in the muddy wall, and several feet later, an even rustier horseshoe. 100 years ago, animals had labored under the streets, hauling stone. Some archaeologists believed that even the Romans brought horses down here to help them haul limestone they'd used to build arenas and bathhouses. The air was musty now, but Anya imagined that it must have been so filled with dust in centuries past that workers would have choked on it. Another few yards and she reached a seriously porous section, a length of wall clearly close to collapsing. She knew that very few Parisians living above realized how dicey the foundations of their city had become in places. Anya had read about various collapses, one shortly before America had declared its independence from England. Houses and businesses along Avenue d'Enfer Rochereau had fallen. Years later, there were more collapses, and King Louis XVI ordered crews down to shore up the quarries. They'd started dumping bones there shortly thereafter. Work continued to this day to bolster the walls of the catacombs. The most recent collapse of note was sometime in the 1960s, when an entire Parisian neighborhood had disappeared into a big hole. The corridor branched, and Anya looked for more garbage, like a bird following breadcrumbs. She barely avoided falling into a dark hole the lantern hadn't penetrated. Anya caught her foot at the edge of it and tumbled, rolling to keep the lantern from breaking. Then she held it over the hole and looked down. The light didn't stretch to the bottom. It would have been quite a drop. But there were scratch marks along the lip, hinting that somebody had ventured up it. It would have been a tight fit. Anya picked herself up and continued to follow the passage, seeing more graffiti on the left wall, but not taking the time to read it. Soon, she came to a pit. It was big, and she had to press herself against the wall and inch around it, shale giving way beneath her toes as she went. Probably what was left of an old well. She saw black water with an oily residue floating on it. There was another chamber with bones, this one arranged like an actual crypt, more orderly and with chalk notations near some of the remains. Anya resisted the temptation to read them. She stopped cold when her lantern revealed a body face down in the center of the passage.
Shoo!
The rats didn't move away until she stamped her feet. A closer look showed him to be a young man, probably dead only a day or two, his head crushed by a rock. Murdered? There was rubble around him, and Anya glanced at the ceiling. No, part of the tunnel had collapsed on him. She'd tell the police about this, too. There was still no way up, but she saw evidence people had been here in a crushed cigarette pack and a discarded Coke can. The corridor widened, and Anya blinked to make sure she was seeing correctly. Limestone blocks had been carefully arranged like benches with cushions on them, a lawn chair to one side. A sleeping bag was stretched out across other blocks with two pillows. On the wall behind was a mural, something abstract like Picasso painted in his late years, all in blues. The smell was different here. The fustiness remained, but with a hint of apples and cinnamon. She saw air fresheners spaced throughout the room.
Home sweet home.
There were niches in the wall, recently carved from the look of the sharp edges. Thick candles sat in them. Another niche contained a big camping lantern.
And why couldn't the occupant be home now?
He, or she, would know the quickest route out of here. A good sign, though, despite Anya's disapproval of the underground being disturbed in this way. She looked for more breadcrumbs to follow, taking the middle of three exit tunnels from the unknown cataphile's quarters. The tunnel finally started to climb, branched again, and Anya chose the left one by instinct. She was rewarded more than a dozen yards later when it turned.
Ugh.
Anya was struck by a horrible stench. Wastewater coursed through a channel at her feet, and to the side ran a thick pipe that probably carried water for cleaning streets, watering city properties, and supplying fire hydrants.
Yes!
Her light played on a blue and yellow sign that dangled from the ceiling. Rue des Rosiers. She tromped through the wastewater and headed toward it. A handful of yards ahead, a ladder led up to a manhole cover. Anya knew the street ran roughly parallel to Rue Rambuteau, a large thoroughfare. She had no idea where she'd traveled, not with all the twisting, turning, doubling back, rising and falling. But she knew where she was coming out. Rue des Rosiers wasn't very long, and there was a police station nearby.
Yes, yes, yes.
The wastewater rose higher over Anya's feet. She was in desperate need of the police, Rue, and a hot bath. Her heart pounded. A good cleansing. Anya dropped the lantern at the base of the ladder. She started to climb. Rue stood by the curtained partition to Anya's ER bed. She sat on the edge, staring at the cast on her arm, to which the nurse was hooking a sling. Rue's face was scraped and his hands crisscrossed with scabs. Anya suspected he had worse wounds under his ragged clothes. Anya's face was covered in small bandages, as was her right hand. There were more beneath the gray sweatpants and navy sweatshirt a policewoman had loaned her after Anya had stumbled into the station and told the story about the warehouse, the swordsman, and the liquid nerve gas. They'd believed her. She looked as if she'd been through a war and had two stolen swords as evidence. More than that, her celebrity gave her credibility. The commander on duty was a regular viewer of Chasing History's Monsters. At her insistence, they'd let Anya clean the stink of the underground off in their locker room shower before driving her to the hospital.
I'd really rather not to make a habit of this, Anya, visiting you in the hospital. I'd prefer not to see you battered and bloodied so often.
You don't look so good either. I'm glad you're all right. I'm getting out of here in a few minutes. I'm not waiting for the doctor.
No arguments, Anya.
You should wait, miss. The doctor will be back in a little while to give you instructions and a prescription for antibiotics. Here's a pamphlet about managing your cast. Your doctor back home will have to take this off in 3 to 6 weeks. It's all there in the pamphlet.
She pressed it into Anya's hand. When the nurse left, Anya slid off the bed, slipped into a pair of tennis shoes, hand-me-downs from a second policewoman, and dropped the paper in the wastebasket.
I'm not waiting for the doctor.
No argument.
Rue followed Anya to the parking lot.
The police. You told them about the warehouse.
It was one of 4 warehouses in the area.
Recovered?
Yeah, I went back to the area. I wasn't awake when they moved me. Only 4 buildings were large enough for it to be where we were held. I contacted the police.
I didn't see you at the station I went to. I
didn't go there in person, Anya. But I learned later that you had. I didn't know about the nerve chemicals at the time. I didn't know anything about what was in the warehouse.
It was under the warehouse. The nerve gas is real. I saw it. Maybe I should have brought a canister with me. I don't know. Lord, but I hope they get it all. 9 crates. What the hell was he going to do with them? What if there were more? What if he had more someplace else? What if...
Anya, while you were in the hospital, the police found the warehouse. They didn't find any liquid nerve gas in the tunnel below. Just empty crates.
Dear God.
The police are still there. A sergeant I know will let us in. They're still searching.
Rouen.
That does seem to be where he plans to create his city of God.
Why Rouen?
Rue pointed to a car, small and sleek. Anya wondered if it was his or a rental. She hurried toward the vehicle, her mind churning with ugly possibilities. A pair of officers on duty outside the warehouse stopped Anya and Rue. There was a barricade on the street, an assortment of police cars and SUVs, and a large van that a man in a white hazmat bodysuit stood beside. There were dogs, too. A trio of German shepherds sitting dutifully by a police car, unleashed.
You can't go inside.
Officer, here's my card. Could you please show it to your sergeant in there?
I'll check, but I can't guarantee anything.
Thank you.
The officer retreated inside the warehouse, returning a few minutes later with a sulky look on his face. He waved the two of them in.
Just don't touch anything. We're dusting, understand?
You bet.
The place sent shivers through Anya. In the center sat the pile of wood where they'd started to burn her. A dozen officers moved slowly through the cavernous room. Some took pictures. Others were dusting surfaces for fingerprints. One was in the rafters. A woman who had some authority, judging by her uniform and the patch on her sleeve, came down the spiral staircase. She looked to be in her late 30s or early 40s, prim, pressed, and all business.
You can go up. Look, but don't touch anything.
Anya detected a comfortable familiarity between this officer and Rue. Perhaps this was his source in the Paris Police Department. Perhaps something more. Anya decided not to ask as she passed by. She took the stairs two at a time. An icy feeling settled in her stomach as she reached the top. The door was not what one would expect to find in a warehouse, not when everything below was cement, corrugated steel, and aluminum. It was a black door that looked like the lid of a coffin, with a wreath of dead flowers hanging on it.
The place of a madman. Don't touch anything, huh?
Well, she had to touch the black doorknob to go in. Her fingers closed on it, and she waited a beat. Rue wasn't coming up the stairs. A glance over the rail showed him waiting with the policewoman. Anya went inside. The room looked like a small art gallery, the furnishings scant but opulent. Brocade cushions padded high-backed chairs carved out of bleached wood. Candelabras were filled with fresh candles. Anya stepped onto a thick rug that was shot through with metallic threads. A velvet rope stretched across one section of wall, perhaps to keep Lawton's visitors from getting too close to the paintings. The walls were dark maroon, which helped show off the portraits that hung everywhere. The place was completely incongruous with the warehouse under it. The largest painting, directly opposite the door she'd entered and lit from above, mounted in an ornate gilded frame, was of a well-dressed, middle-aged man with black curly hair past his shoulders. There was a hint of white at his temples and lines around his eyes. All the dark pictures looked as if they'd been rendered by old masters, reminding Anya of Rembrandt's self-portrait. The men and women were dressed expensively, from the 1300s through perhaps 1500. But the large portrait of the black-haired man clearly held the place of honor in the room. She went behind the velvet rope for a closer look.
Charles Lawton.
The portrait was supposed to be of Charlemagne, according to the words embedded in the frame, but the resemblance to Lawton was unmistakable. It wasn't the same man she'd seen in Paris, in the lecture hall, or ordering her burned. Lawton didn't have someone paint Charlemagne with his own face on it, but it was close. The painting looked authentic, and Anya searched her memory for other portraits of Charlemagne she'd seen.
Dear God. Oh, dear God.
That's what had been niggling at the back of her brain when she'd first seen Lawton at the auction in Spain. A sense of familiarity. She had seen him before. An echo of him, in any event, in images of Charlemagne. So unless Lawton had hired a plastic surgeon to make himself look like Charlemagne, he could pass for the historic figure's son or brother. Descendant, definitely. Descendant of Charlemagne and student of Charlemagne. Lawton had apparently built his life around his ancestor.
But why try to build a city of God now? Why not a decade ago or a decade in the future? Is there something important about this timing? Or has he been laying the groundwork for a long time? And why is my sword so damn important to his collection?
Anya turned away from the portrait, but the image of Charlemagne still burned in her brain. She stared at the opposite wall. By the door she'd entered was another striking portrait, this one nearly as big as Charlemagne's, but in a less ornate frame. In fact, it looked as if the weathered wood could crumble at any moment.
Not possible.
But somehow it was indeed possible. Anya had seen images of Joan of Arc. She'd once stood inches from a statue of Joan, rendered by the French sculptor François Rude. But this version of Joan that Anya now gazed upon had been in many of Anya's dreams and nightmares, sometimes dressed just as she was in this painting. According to historians, only one portrait was painted of Joan with her sword, and it was lost, likely destroyed in a fire. But it hadn't been destroyed. Anya knew that this was it. A little brass plaque affixed to the frame read, "Jeanne d'Arc, Maid of Orléans." Charles Lawton, who had the money to buy ancient swords, finance this warehouse operation, and who knew what else, had the lost painting hanging on his wall. It was beautiful. Joan was beautiful. And Anya found herself drawn to the face. Anya looked nothing like her, though Rue had thought she must be related somehow. The Joan in the painting wore a boy's white shirt, open to midway down her chest, showing off a scar. Through the ages, white had served as an emblem of purity, and here it stood in stark contrast to the dark pants she had on, frayed around the cuffs. She wore men's boots of an old military style. On the ground in front of her was a white banner, again symbolizing her purity. A fleur-de-lis, the French emblem, could be seen on a fold of it. Her hair was cut short, and she could have passed for a boy. Probably did on the battlefield. The sword was in her lap, her right hand holding the pommel. It was Anya's sword, exactly the same. A cross, likely bronze from the color of the old oils, rested in Joan's lap as well, partially obscured by the sword. There was an engraving on the cross, but Anya couldn't make it out. The paint had spiderweb fine cracks in it. The signature of the artist was also obscured. Would restoration reveal the engraving and the artist? Behind Joan, the image of St. Catherine's Church in Rouen was hazy, as if a fog lay across the land. What Anya at first had thought were a collection of stick-like trees were actually French soldiers. She knew the story of Joan of Arc by heart. What she hadn't learned in history classes in school and college, she'd gained through her own studies. The patron saint of France had brought the nation together at a critical time and swung the Hundred Years' War in her country's favor. After a moment, Anya crossed to a display case that contained an ink-drawn map on a piece of parchment. A pencil notation at the bottom read, "Circa 1400." Anya had to lean close to make out the details. It was a village called Domremy. Joan was raised there by her parents. Historians thought she was 12 or 13 when she claimed to have heard celestial voices. These voices persisted, urging her to help the Dauphin to become King of France. She managed to convince him of her divine mission to save the country and was handed troops to command. Later, however, when the Dauphin became king, he refused to support her military operations against the English. Bourguignon soldiers captured her and sold her to their English allies, who in turn gave her to an ecclesiastical court in Rouen. Another map in the case revealed that city in 1400. Joan was held there for more than a year, tried for heresy, and finally condemned to death. The sentence was commuted, but later reinstated by a secular court. Joan was burned at the stake in the old market square of Rouen, highlighted on the map by a pen drawing of a campfire. Anya remembered the feel of the fire licking against her and seeing Lawton's determination through the smoke. Mostly, she remembered her terror. There were other items in the glass case, an old book opened to a page of text.
25 years after the inconceivable slaying of the Maid of Orléans, the church pronounced her innocent.
It would be hundreds of years later, in 1920, that she was canonized by Pope Benedict XV. Under a short sword on display, a plaque read, "Charlemagne's first weapon." Not God-touched, Anya suspected, else it would have been in the hands of one of Lawton's paladins. There was a mounting for another sword, however, and it was empty.
Is it meant for mine?
Anya understood why the professor wished to have her sword. It didn't contain the tooth or blood of some saint or a piece of the Virgin Mary's robe, but it had been wielded by a saint, Joan of Arc. And more than that, it had once belonged to Charlemagne, Lawton's ancestor. Anya moved on, noting a few places where the residue from fingerprinting powder remained. She doubted the police knew how valuable some of the pieces in this warehouse were. Maybe they'd find more than Lawton's prints. Maybe some of his followers were terrorists. If the police had found other clues here, they'd likely already gathered the evidence.
Where is Rue? Still talking to the officer?
Anya hoped he was trying to learn what the police had discovered. She continued her tour of the room, trying to take in everything. The place, the people in the portraits on the walls, some of whom bore a resemblance to Charlemagne and Lawton. Relatives? She'd nearly passed it by, but her eye for detail was sharp. There was a place in the carpet that was rubbed, as if something had sat on it or been moved across it. She squatted and ran her fingers over the weave. The police had told her not to touch anything, but they wouldn't mind her messing with the carpet, wouldn't even know it. They'd left her up here alone. Anya smiled. Rue was talking to the policewoman to buy Anya time to explore the place.
Interesting.
She traced the carpet depression back to the wall.
Really interesting.
Anya stood and studied it. There was an almost imperceptible break in the paint at the edge of one of the unidentified portraits. She pushed on the wall. It popped open.
A secret door. How utterly original, Dr. Lawton.
It would have been left open had the police found it, and the edges of the panel would have been dusted for fingerprints, leaving residue behind. She'd tell them about it on her way out, after she was done exploring. Anya slipped inside. The size of a large closet, the space had two file cabinets, a toilet, and a sink. There were cleansers on the floor and feather dusters, probably used for keeping the gallery clean, and even a portable vacuum that looked to be battery-operated. She started with the cabinets, pulling the bottom door out slowly. For all the money he'd spent on the room and on the swords, Anya thought he could have afforded better file cabinets. She worked quickly. Rue wouldn't be able to engage the policewoman in conversation indefinitely. Scanning documents, she found little of interest. Term papers, mostly, which she would have thought Lawton would have kept in his office at the university. But maybe these were from particularly bright students, ones he could groom into followers. She selected one at random and stuck it behind her back in the waistband of the sweatpants, pulling the sweatshirt over it. In the top drawer, she found nothing of note. Records on the warehouse, taxes, and the like. Things the police might have an interest in, however. The second cabinet yielded more student papers, but a middle drawer caught her attention. The first few folders were filled with newspaper clippings and printouts from internet sites about famous swords, where they were being auctioned or exhibited. There were articles on Honjo Masamune, the Wallace sword, El Cid's Tithona, and more. Behind these were blueprints. Anya tugged them out. The first was of the Wallace Monument near Stirling. Another of West Point in New York. A street map of Avignon was wedged between them and fluttered to the floor. The Louvre. Anya bit her lip. Charlemagne's Joyeuse was on display in the Louvre.
How does Lawton get such detailed blueprints? How does he come by anything?
Blueprints for the Tower of London with handwritten notes about monitors.
Son of a...
He was going after Joyeuse and the swords kept with the crown jewels. Anya had known that he would. This was no great revelation, just a confirmation. Obsessed with Charlemagne and with swords, the professor would insist on having his ancestor's famous weapon. That he hadn't gone after it earlier surprised her. Why not make that his first target? He'd managed break-ins at the Wallace Monument and other museums. Security at the Louvre and the Tower of London would be tenfold compared to what his paladins had previously tackled. Maybe it was the high-level security that had kept him away. Anya tried to tell herself the Louvre could not be robbed. But it had been robbed before. She looked through the contents of more folders, going faster now. News clippings. Anya passed by the first batch, but then gave them a quick study. A paragraph in one of the articles was circled. Dated November 7, 2005, it quoted a Muslim rioter talking about revenge for the deaths of two fellow Muslims who were electrocuted while trespassing at a power station.
It won't end until two policemen are dead.
The paper clipped to it was a handwritten note with a dozen addresses. Where Muslims were living in Rouen? France had a sizable Muslim population, estimated to be between 5 and 6 million. Another clipping was an article about Jewish communities throughout the world, citing that France had the largest population of Jews in all of Europe. Census estimates put the number at about 500,000, most of them in metropolitan areas, including Rouen. Folded behind it were a photograph and an article about a Jewish archaeological find in Rouen that experts believed was a yeshiva, a school for Jewish religious studies. The site was uncovered in the 1970s during a restoration project on one of Rouen's court buildings. The site suggested that at one time the city was a Jewish center and cemented the image of France as a melting pot. The address and tour information were circled. The monument was open to the public. Anya cringed. There were other clippings, small ones, on a Hindu speed dating gathering scheduled for next week in a hotel ballroom in Rouen, an upcoming Wiccan gathering in a meeting room at the public library, an approaching lecture by a local Rastafarian. There was a scrawled note about Sikhism and a partial address, but something had been spilled on it and she couldn't make it out. Anya could spend hours in here going through every folder, losing herself in the collection of clippings and papers, and trying to ferret out Lawton's list of priorities. That would be for the police, though. They were resourceful and could throw enough people at the project to sift through it quickly, if they realized how much of a threat Lawton was, that he had liquid nerve gas. The police knew just how serious this was. They weren't stupid. but she couldn't leave it all on them. Anya caught sight of herself in the mirror over the sink. She looked like hell. Strands of her hair hung in clumps around her face. She reached up with her right hand and tucked them behind her ears, then picked off bandages the nurse had put on her cheeks. Already she was healing underneath. Her broken arm would take a little while, though. She dropped the bandages in the wastebasket.
Wait, the police don't need to think they're clues to anything regarding Lawton.
As she bent to pluck them out, Anya saw an empty pill vial in the basket. She stared at the mirror, which served as the door to a medicine cabinet. Opening it, she took a quick inventory of the contents. It revealed the usual stuff: aspirin, antacids, band-aids, rubbing alcohol, and two prescription bottles reading temozolomide and isotretinoin. With no idea what they treated, she pocketed them to look it up later.
Tampering with police evidence.
She'd clue them in if this led to anything concrete. Poking her head out of the secret closet, Anya scampered into the room, gesturing toward the panel door when the policewoman and Rue came in. The officer's surprise quickly melted into anger. She looked from Anya to Rue.
I think you two should be on your way.
Certainly.
Anya slid into the car beside Rue, who pulled away from the warehouse and headed north.
Thank you.
Not a problem. I always enjoy talking to Beatrice.
Learn anything?
Only that the police are taking this dead serious. They believe you about the liquid nerve gas. The description you gave matched other cylinders recovered from terrorist groups in the Middle East. Interpol is sending agents.
He didn't have a computer. Not upstairs, anyway. Paper, though. Lots of it. Old-fashioned. Did the police say if they found a computer upstairs?
They carried out boxes.
Evidence of something.
This reliance you have on computers, Anya.
They make things easy, that's all. Do you have one with you? A netbook, an iPad, a...
Whatever for.
I want to look something up.
She stretched back her good arm, pulling the student paper out and dropping it behind the seat to look at later. Then she dug in her pocket for the prescription bottles.
I should have left them for the police, but they've still got an empty one to work with in the trash.
Rue turned into a retail district. Sale signs were plastered across a few of the store windows, garish and bright and meant to attract customers like a fish to a shiny spinning lure. It was working. Shoppers were streaming into the largest place. Left hand on the wheel, Rue took the bottles from her with his right. He read the label, then sat straight and gave the traffic his full attention.
Temozolomide. What's the other one?
He turned the bottle so he could read it. Anya couldn't make out the dosing information as she tried to read around his fingers.
They're both prescribed for Charles Lawton. This one is isotretinoin.
I want a computer to look them up and...
They're cancer drugs, Anya.
How would you know?
I have lost friends through these years. Not just the sword fights. Temozolomide, Temodar, is prescribed to slow the growth of certain cancers. Same for the other drug. Since he has prescriptions for both, I'd say he has a brain tumor.
I don't follow your logic.
Well, it would explain quite a bit.
The way he's acting, the obsession, the driven single-mindedness and...
No, it could explain why he's moving so quickly. He's running out of time. But I think the plan was there a long while ago. I don't think a brain tumor has triggered his plan for a city of God.
All right, I'll give you that. If he thought he was dying, he would be desperate to build it in whatever time he had left. Charlemagne, after all, died before he could see it happen.
Rue turned left and pulled over to the curb.
But why Rouen? Why build a city there and not here in Paris?
Because the Christians in Rouen got it wrong, Anya. And in the process of building his city of God, he's going to show them how to get it right. At least, that's why I think he selected that city. A good place to start, huh?
Anya pressed herself even deeper into the seat. Rue was talking about Joan of Arc, the trial that had branded her a heretic and had had her burned at the stake. It was the church, Christians, who had tried her and killed her, burned her body 3 times so there was nothing left to bury. They'd taken it back later, a do-over as it were, and then named her a saint. But they'd gotten it wrong the first time.
Lawton is getting it wrong, too. Killing Buddhists and...
Scientologists.
Anya told Rue about the clippings mentioning upcoming events for Jews, Rastafarians, and Wiccans in Rouen.
Killing everyone who isn't Christian doesn't seem very Christian to me.
Wars in the name of God. In any event, that is why I suspect Rouen.
But we're not going there first. We're going to Rouen. Well, I am. Lawton and his paladins will be heading there, and that's probably where they'll release the nerve gas.
Beatrice said the police in Rouen have been put on alert.
But I think he's got another stop or two planned first.
The Louvre.
Yeah, it has to be on his list. He wants Charlemagne's sword.
La Joyeuse.
There are others on his shopping list, but from what I've gathered, they're with the crown jewels in the Tower of London.
No more formidable than the Louvre.
But farther away. He'll go for Joyeuse first. We didn't leave him a choice, did we, Rue? The police are swarming his place. He's got to speed up his timetable.
Then why not just...
go to Rouen right away and start cleansing it? Because he doesn't have a sword. He wanted mine. Said Charlemagne had it first. That it should be his. Arshar had Durindal, Luke, Honjo Masamune. That short dude was swinging the Wallace sword at me. There were some other blades out in the parking lot last night that looked like they could have come from a museum.
Tithona.
It might have been out there too. It was pretty dark.
There was a lot going on.
Controlled chaos. I don't think Lawton bought Tithona for himself. For one of his paladins, certainly, but he'd want something with a Charlemagne angle. Whether because he's obsessed with his Charlemagne ancestry or the brain tumor is to blame, he's going after a sword his ancestor used.
Rue pulled out into traffic and turned north at the next intersection.
To the Louvre, then.
You don't have to go with me.
One never gets tired of seeing that museum.
The Louvre had had its share of thefts. In 1998, Sèvres Road by Camille Corot was taken from an exhibit room that didn't have video surveillance. Police believed a collector of 19th-century Impressionist paintings likely hired someone to make off with the $1.3 million work. In 1911, an Italian worker stole the Mona Lisa, which helped make the painting one of the most famous in the world. Only a decade ago, officials at the Louvre had acknowledged that a pair of 18th-century candlesticks had been stolen, worth about $60,000. They'd been reported missing earlier, but the museum had managed to keep the fact quiet for some time. Auditors discovered that the museum had poor records of just how many pieces of art and artifacts it owned, and that it had been plagued by more thefts than it reported. Word had crept out that even a marble statue had been taken from one of the galleries. So Anya knew that while the museum's security had improved, it was not infallible, and certainly not what it should be considering the treasures it contained. In its defense, museum staff continued to cite a small budget. Reporters from time to time printed stories about insufficient guards and employees that took coffee breaks stretching into hours. More than 6 million people visited the Louvre each year. One of them was going to be Lawton. Built on the banks of the Seine, the Louvre wasn't a museum originally. It was first intended as a fortress, then a palace, and later as a repository for Henry VI's works of art. But it was opened to the public as a museum more than 200 years ago. Anya had seen Charlemagne's sword there in passing, twice, but had never stopped to really look at it. She'd been more caught up in the various collections of European paintings and sculptures. On one visit, she'd spent hours in the rooms devoted to Roman, Egyptian, and Greek art. She sat quietly now, watching the pedestrians and traffic as Rue drove. Her thoughts drifted to Raymond and his grandchild, and to her producer, whom she hadn't contacted for a few days. There was a story here for Chasing History's Monsters, about Charlemagne and his descendant, Charles Lawton, the collection of God-touched swords, and Lawton's plans to build a city of God. But it wasn't a story she wanted to film. It was a story she'd been forced to take a starring role in, and she wanted no part of it. At the end of the street, she could see a section of the Louvre. Traffic was heavy in this area, with many people heading home from work. The museum would be open for only another hour. The wing along the Seine, where she would find Charlemagne's sword, was built during the 16th century. To get there, they would go through the Richelieu wing, which had been added 300 years later. The most recent addition was the Glass Pyramid, a controversial project constructed in 1989 by the American architect I.M. Pei. Anya didn't like it. While the pyramid let sunlight shine down into an underground floor, she felt it incongruous to the old, classic feel of the rest of the place. Rue fell silent and found a place to park. They walked the few blocks and paid to get in.
You've only got an hour.
That should be enough.
Watch me be wrong.
Hmm?
Watch my guest be the wrong one. Watch him go after the swords in the Tower of London or after innocent people in Rouen.
So, you're changing your mind. Women do that.
No, I'm not. I'm just hoping he doesn't outthink me here and do something else.
Anya started toward the wing where she remembered seeing Charlemagne's sword.
First floor, Richelieu wing. Hope they haven't moved it. Should have asked, I guess.
The French police are good. They have the best people on the nerve gas hunt.
Interpol is good, too.
Anya picked up the pace, passing people who were clearly weary, their rounded shoulders and slow gait indicators that they'd spent hours here. One tall man rubbed his eyes with one hand and the back of his neck with the other. A solid day of museuming, as Anya called it, was hard work. The sculptures and old masters she passed were a blur of colors, the chatter of the other visitors a buzz that she shoved to the back of her mind. Eyes darting everywhere, Anya tried to find a familiar face, one of Lawton's paladins. She could have sworn she'd spotted Luke, but a second look showed the black man to be not tall enough. Anya realized she was huffing and drawing looks from the tourists, so she slowed down, but only a little, never glancing over her shoulder. She knew Rue was there. Finally, she came to the second room in the Richelieu wing, filled with collections of decorative arts from the Middle Ages to the 19th century. Relics from Napoleon glittered for her attention.
There, Joyeuse.
Anya was struck by the magnificence of the sword. A dozen people milled here. One woman, squat-looking and on the arm of a young man, gave her a passing glance. The rest were men of various ages, enjoying the artistic weapons on display. These weren't simply old military pieces the Louvre put in cases for the public to see. These were ones that glittered and gleamed, as much works of art as the paintings by Picasso, Michelangelo, and Renoir.
Why didn't I pay attention to the sword on my previous trips? It's truly a work of art.
A pair of Italian gentlemen stood as close to the exhibit as they could, so Anya had to wait behind them, peering through the gap between them.
The sword of a king.
Indeed.
It was displayed tipped down in a thick case, probably some type of plastic. Joyeuse was one of the most famous swords in the world. The traditional coronation sword of France, it had been reproduced by weapons makers everywhere and hung across fireplaces.
He already has Charlemagne's saber, you know. When I was in the hospital...
Which time?
I researched missing swords. Charlemagne's saber was stolen from the imperial treasury in Vienna. The same night...
The Hun sword was taken. I can use the internet too, you know. This sword is very much a mystery.
There's some debate if it was actually Charlemagne's. Some say the proportions are wrong to have come from Charlemagne's time, and they argue that after 1,200 years, the original wouldn't have survived. But the parts...
The museum will be closing soon. Proceed to the exits.
At the announcement, a half dozen of the people slowly made their way out, leaving six remaining visitors.
Some of the parts are said to come from 800 or thereabout. Others say pieces are from the early 13th century. One antiquarian even thought there was Western craftsmanship involved. Another put it at mid-7th century. I remember reading an article back when I was studying sword making that a sword of this proportion would be no earlier than the 1100s.
So, a mystery. But there is another explanation for the anachronisms, yes?
Yes. Alterations were made to it through the years.
Very good.
Thank you.
The plaque beneath the exhibit said the sword had been used to crown Philip the Bold in 1270. Anya stared at the hilt and listened to the Italian men read from a pamphlet.
The hilt was heavily sculpted of gold and had been made in two halves resembling a bulky oak shot, whatever that is. The grip, decorated with fleurs de lis and diamonds, was removed for Napoleon's coronation in 1804. The gold cross bears twin-winged dragons with lapis lazuli eyes.
The blade glistened in the light of the display case. The scabbard behind it... Anya doubted there was anything left of the original, except perhaps bits of gilded silver and the gems. The velvet and gold-embroidered fleur-de-lis were added in 1824, according to the pamphlet she read over the shoulder of the Italians, for the coronation of Charles X. Rue was right calling it anachronistic. Bits of this year, bits of that decade, but at the sword's heart, its blade. The blade had been dated to medieval times, the 9th century or earlier. It could certainly have been wielded by Charlemagne. Legend said its pommel contained the tip of the Lance of Longinus, which was said to have Christ's blood on it.
Forged from the same stuff as Ogier's Cortana and Roland's Durandal.
The man was standing in the doorway between this room and the next exhibit. He was the gaunt German Anya remembered from the warehouse, Ulrich.
The museum is closing. Proceed to the exit.
The pair of Italians walked past Ulrich.
It is good advice. You should be leaving the museum, too.
Then the other four tourists left. Anya and Rue were alone with him. Anya reached for her sword, feeling the weight of it in her hand.
There were surveillance cameras in this room. She'd spotted them when she entered. Whether they worked was another matter. Not all the ones in the Louvre did, though the general public didn't know that. Rue started toward him, but Anya put a hand on his sleeve.
He's mine.
In that same instant, Ulrich reached into his pocket. He was wearing gloves, and he pulled out a mask and held it to his face. Anya tugged on Rue's arm.
You've got to alert security. Help people get out of here.
Anya.
Don't argue. Hurry.
Ulrich stepped to the side as Rue rushed past him, fast for an old man.
The liquid nerve gas. He has some here, doesn't he?
Anya could see Ulrich smile through the mask, which Anya realized also served as a respirator. His clothes were tight-fitting, his shirt a turtleneck with long sleeves, and with the mask, every inch of his skin appeared to be covered. Ulrich reached behind his back and drew Elcide's tithona. Anya blinked, her eyes watering. They'd gotten the nerve gas into the air ducts, a rotten way to neutralize the museum's security.
Damn Lawton.
Perhaps Charles will be damned to hell, but you'll be dying first, Miss Creed.
Ulrich came forward slowly, arms out, and the tip of the sword scraping one of the exhibits. Anya's eyes were watering fiercely, and she found her lungs tightening, the gas seeping inside her.
Has Rue gotten out, warned security? Did he get straggling tourists out as well?
Nerve gas was among the vicious chemical mixes considered weapons of mass destruction, outlawed by countries throughout the world. Anya went on the offensive, lunging and batting away his parry. He could fence, though he wasn't as good as Luke, but he didn't need to be. All he had to do was keep her here long enough. Anya slashed at his leg, slicing through his pants and drawing blood. He was still safe, she realized. This gas probably had to be inhaled to do harm, and it was doing significant harm to her. Already hobbled with a broken arm, she was going down fast. Her vision was failing, no doubt her pupils contracting. Minutes left, her chest tightened as if caught in a vise. Anya drove the blade forward, catching her opponent's arm. She felt the blade connect with his bone. He was so skinny, and through the mask, she saw surprise. He made a feeble attempt to strike her. Tithona, glancing off her cast, cutting only the sling that held it close to her body. Hot pain pulsed from the broken arm, but the sensation gave her the impetus she needed. Falling, she shoved the blade up at an odd angle, sliding the steel between his ribs and finding his lungs. Ulrich's mask filled with blood, and he dropped. Anya scrambled over him, releasing her sword and reaching for his mask, shaking uncontrollably and somehow finding the strength to tug it off him. Shortly, the nausea passed. Anya continued to shake, but was able to press the mask to her face. She sprawled there, awkwardly strapping the mask around her head with her good arm.
Deep. Breathe deep.
Anya could hardly see out the mask for Ulrich's blood, but she couldn't risk taking it off to clean it. She stayed still another minute, two, the shaking stopping for the most part, but her fingers quivering as if they'd been electrified. She needed a hospital, a decontamination center. Anyone caught in the museum needed one.
Has Rue alerted people?
Anya struggled to her feet. Unsteady, she leaned against the wall, trying to see through the blood-spattered mask. Decontamination center, drugs. In her life, she'd been shot, hit by a car, thrown through windows. Nerve gas was a first for her, and not something she ever wanted to experience again. Anya glanced toward Charlemagne's sword in its case. It was safe. Lawton wouldn't be... She was driven to the floor by a vicious kick to her back. Anya rolled and rolled, putting distance between herself and her new assailant, catching a glimpse of him through gaps in the blood and still not able to make him out. He was darkly dressed, every inch of him covered, with a mask similar to the one she was wearing. The sword, though, she recognized. Hanjo Masamune. Anya sprang to her feet, sword in hand. She met him sideways, so her broken arm was away from him. Anya knocked away his blow. Luke wasn't using two swords today. Perhaps pressing his luck getting one in through security, or because he needed to bring other things with him, such as his respirator. Whatever the reason, Anya was thankful she had only one weapon to worry about. He was quick, and he darted around her, his eyes flitting past her to Joyeuse's case. His leaps and thrusts were perfectly executed, but Anya parried each one. They were designed to wear her down. She was already worn down as far as she could be and still managed to stay on her feet. He wasn't merely trying to capture her now, as per his orders in the faculty parking lot at the university. He was trying to kill her. His strokes were stronger and more vicious, and she had to work harder to keep his blade at bay. Anya kept looking for an opening, but he wasn't giving her one. And with her vision impaired because of the mask, matters were grim indeed. Hearing the sirens, Luke moved even faster. There was nothing flashy in his moves. That stuff was for exhibits. A good swordsman worked quickly, with simple actions designed to kill, not entertain. And a good swordsman, or swordswoman, didn't let a match go on any longer than necessary. It was just long enough. Anya couldn't see clearly, and she was still racked with tremors, but she'd been able to detect a rhythm in Luke's footwork. He was predictable after all. Another few minutes to make sure she was right. Luke landed a blow against her sword arm. She turned, but not fast enough, and Tithona sliced through the sweatshirt. He drew back. Anya fell to her knees, jamming her sword up with as much force as she could find. The blade sank into his stomach, and she pushed until it was up to the hilt. He fell on her. Anya was finally able to crawl out from under him. She released the pommel of her sword, and it vanished, leaving him flat on the marble, with blood pooling around his jerking fingers. She started to leave, then stopped, turned, and peered at Joyeuse through her blood-spattered mask. It was safe. Anya returned to Luke's body and picked up Hanjo Masamune, holding it under her arm. She managed to grab Tithona, too. These swords would have to be returned to their rightful owners as well, she thought, as she stumbled out of the room. She didn't see a soul in the halls. Anya prayed everyone had managed to make it out, though she suspected some museum staff members must have fallen to the gas. Lawton would have considered them collateral damage. She should make her way to the bowels of the complex and figure out where the nerve gas was released and how many canisters were used. See if she could find a way to shut it down, if there was any of it left to shut down. She should, but she lurched toward the exit instead, self-preservation kicking in. Anya made it out of the museum to the sidewalk, taking in the police cars and ambulances, the crowd of people kept back by hastily erected barriers, the news crews that were arriving, before two men in hazmat gear took her by the arms, which was awkward considering one of her arms was in a cast, and she was carrying two swords. They stripped her and put her in a makeshift shower that had been set up in a white tent on the street. About three dozen other museum visitors had been given the same treatment and whisked off to one of Paris's hospitals. Anya didn't have the strength or the voice to put up more than a feeble protest when they loaded her on a stretcher and sent her on her way. She had a second shower at the hospital, lathered with a sweet-smelling, oily solution, then was dressed in a faded green, drafty gown and assigned to a bed in the maternity ward. It was the only empty private room available, and she'd heard someone demand that she get special attention. A nurse told her they'd thrown away her clothes and shoes. Anya made a mental note to find the policewomen and reimburse them for the loss. A doctor explained that the antidotes they'd shot her full of were designed to do the opposite of what the nerve gas did. She was no longer salivating, her eyes had dilated, and the tremors had stopped. She felt hungry, famished. There was no sign of long-lasting or permanent damage, the doctor said, though after questioning, he revealed that 18 of the museum staff had died, and that more than a dozen of those treated were left with irreversible nerve and brain damage.
Damn Lawton to hell.
It was little consolation that he'd waited until the museum was closed to unleash the gas. After the doctor left her alone in the hospital room, Anya closed her eyes and waited for Rue. She knew he'd come to visit, and to complain one more time about how tired he was of visiting her in the hospital.
Three canisters in the ventilation system. They covered all the wings of the museum and the lower levels, too.
Rue explained that the body count was higher than originally thought. They'd found more museum staff members in the underground areas, along with one of Lawton's paladins. His respirator hadn't worked.
Which one?
He was a short, stocky man. He didn't have a sword with him.
I recovered Tithona and Honjo Masamune.
Now recover yourself, Anya. I truly am done with visiting you in hospitals. Depressing places. I wasn't going to tell you this, not until they released you, but Joyeuse, in the commotion of clearing out the building, someone got away with it.
So he won.
I wouldn't say so, Anya. You got his forces. He doesn't have the people left to carry out his plan. I'd say that is some measure of victory.
A small victory. Maybe we've stopped Lawton's unholy war. Maybe he'll just get more swords and paladins.
And the police recovered a dozen canisters of nerve gas.
So three more are missing?
Perhaps. But maybe that's all there was. I doubt very much that he has the time to pursue his unholy war. Now, sleep.
No, I can't...
Promise me you'll spend the night?
Ugh. At least the night.
At least.
I have very good insurance, Rue.
Rue gave Anya a faint smile and closed the door behind him. Her head was foggy. She'd forgotten to ask him to get her laptop, cell phone, something so she could do some digging. The archaeologist in her could never stop digging, even if it was electronic. He'd be back to check on her. When he came, Anya would have him bring her... Anya is Joan again, or rather, herself in Joan's place. She is being led through the streets of Rouen, staring at the featureless faces that peer out windows and from street corners. She doesn't wear shoes. Her feet feel ice cold, and the ache intensifies with each step as bits of gravel cut into her heels. Her terror rises the closer she comes to the stake driven into the crossroads. It looms taller than ever before. As she nears the stake, Anya makes out new features. Barbed wire. Jagged pieces of glass sticking out at odd angles. She's thrust up against it, all the hurtful things digging into her arms and back and adding to the agony. Anya stands on wood planks and watches as twigs, sticks, and boards are stacked around her. In the audience, she sees Gaëtan and Luke, dressed in fencing outfits. They bow to her and fit fencing masks over their faces. Behind them, on crutches, is Arshar, whose knees she broke in the tunnels under the warehouse. His face wears its familiar stoic expression. Sarah is several feet away, rubbing shoulders with a vaguely Asian-looking man, Crescendo. The German. Anya looks this way and that. Someone puts a barbed wire necklace around her to keep her from wiggling.
Where is Lawton? Where is the cross? Someone is supposed to press a crude wooden cross into my hands, aren't they? And where's my white gown? Or my boy's clothes? I'm dressed in a faded green hospital gown. Shouldn't my arm be in a sling? Didn't I break it? Where is Lawton?
The faces take on a horrific aspect, looking melted and deformed, like Edvard Munch's The Scream, blood-red sky in the background. But the background isn't the Oslo Fjord. It's the center of Rouen. Anya sees St. Catherine's Church.
Where is Lawton?
Arshar stumbles forward, awkward in his use of the crutches, his leg in a cast covered with hundreds of signatures she can't read. An unlit torch appears in his hand. Arshar blows on it. It catches fire. Arshar sets the torch to the wood, and the world becomes a wall of red-orange, the colors writhing and spinning and changing as if they can't settle on any particular shade. Finally, they turn white, a symbol of purity. Anya pours with sweat. The fire grows larger and larger. As Anya awoke from her nightmare, she saw Rue standing over her, dabbing her forehead with a handkerchief.
Good. Your fever broke. I think they want to keep you for several more days.
One more.
I brought you some newspapers to read.
My laptop?
Of course, on my next visit.
Oh.
Anya settled deeper into the pillow. She'd thank him for that beautiful bouquet of flowers on the stand, too, when he brought her laptop. She waited until he was gone before picking up the first paper. It was The Guardian, and the lead story was about a terrorist attack foiled at the Tower of London.
Police recovered three canisters of cycloserine. Two men were taken into custody in a failed plot to steal arms from the Crown Jewels exhibit.
She skimmed the rest of it and moved on to the next paper and the next. That morning's edition of Le Parisien carried a small notice inside about a university professor who had committed suicide last night. Arshar Gion. Indeed, Lawton's paladins had been removed from the equation. Pity. Arshar seemed to have a few redeeming qualities, and perhaps he could have made good in prison. A nurse came in to give Anya her final dose of antidote.
Lovely flowers. Your admirer has excellent taste.
Anya took a closer look at the arrangement. It was large, filled with Casablanca lilies, gardenias, hydrangeas, lisianthus blooms, and a few stems of stephanotis. A very expensive arrangement. It wouldn't have come from Rue.
May I see the card?
The nurse handed it to her and left.
Meet me Thursday if you are able.
Thursday was the 30th of May. Anya waited nearly 3 hours in the old market square in Rouen, pacing. She had decided she would wait all day if necessary. Scents from the open-air market were thick and pleasant. The old buildings along the street looked somewhat incongruous with the Sainte Jeanne d'Arc church looming behind her. A nearby memorial marked the spot where Joan had been burned at the stake.
Did you know, Miss Creed, that in the final moments of her life, Joan prayed for the souls of her executioners?
And that her final words were, Jesus, Jesus? Yes, I know.
Do you ever hear voices, Miss Creed?
Like Joan claimed she did? Not really.
It would have been marvelous, my city of God.
The air was sweet, if tinged with car exhaust. Not a hint of rain. It had rained for so much of Anya's stay in France. Anya could see a difference in the man from when she'd first spotted him in Spain. His color was sallow, his cheeks a little sunken.
Where is Joyeuse?
Where Joan found her sword. I figured that would be apt. I got to hold it for a while. Feel the history and the divinity of it. The blade. It really was Charlemagne's. And it really was mine for a few days.
Why are you surrendering it?
I am defeated, Miss Creed. Time and my health are my foes, just as they were my ancestors. The City of God goes unfinished. Perhaps some other descendant will take up Charlemagne's banner.
Not if I have anything to say about it.
Rogue Angel's City of Swords is a graphic audio production. Rogue Angel trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2012, Worldwide Library. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication prohibited. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Kimberly Gilbert, Matthew Bassett, Stephen Carpenter, Allison Thomas, Bradley Smith, Christopher Sheeran, Danny Gavigan, David Coyne, Elizabeth Jernigan, Eric Messner, Evan Casey, Jonathan Watkins, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Mort Shelby, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Nick DePinto, Nora Ashrati, Thomas Keegan, Tim Getman, and Yasmin Twazan. Directed by Colleen Delaney. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Allison Thomas. The Rogue Angel theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Doug Krenzlin. If you enjoyed Rogue Angel, be sure to look for Lilith St. Croix's Dante Valentine and Jill Kismet series, John Zakor and Lawrence Ganim's Nuclear Bombshell series, and Christopher L. Bennett's Only Superhuman, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Around here there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free.
Mama, why are my ears so small and so round? Why aren't they like yours? Why are they like Daddy's?
Because, my dear, you are very special.
Special, Mama?
Your father is special. That is why you are, too.
But why?
He's from another world, dear. A world just a little bit different from ours. There are many such worlds, many such existences, universes. They lie side by side, touching as the skins touch on an onlyk. Each skin subtly different, yet subtly the same. We can't see the worlds that interpenetrate ours, but they are there, and they are real to the people or beings living there.
You ever hear me tell about the old days? I remember it as though it were this afternoon. I killed round ears with my sword. Did you know that?
I think I guessed it.
Hard to kill, they were. Great fighters. But the worst of it was they had magic. Weapons such as no sane mind ever imagined. Not swords and crossbows, no. Magical.
Tell me.
Explosive thunders that blew apart men and horses. Lightning that struck with a red bolt and went right through men and war horses and good solid armor. It was as if we were weeds and grass before a fiery scythe. Do you understand what it is to face such things?
You say I'm one of them.
You may be one of them, son, but you haven't their magic. But you will have, won't you?
I don't know.
I never saw anything like that move. You just grabbed my blade right out of my hand. You must be.
You better believe it.
Oh, that hardly seems fair. Magic?
You prate of fair? You who attack nearly unarmed and unskilled boys? You who prey on the weak without a sign of conscience?
Well, kill me then! Kill me and get it over with!
Kill him, youngster!
Yes, strike!
Get him, Cal!
I give him his life.
What? Huckleberry, may I ask why?
Because he's only a man. Only one highwayman.
What are you, daft?
But there are others, many others, as your son has told me.
What are you blethering about?
He can spread the word, he and his wife, about us, what we did today. We won't allow boys to be pressed any longer, or girls. We won't allow anyone to rob or to steal and to kill as he has done.
We'll do it! We'll do it!
Gods, but I believe you'll make a leader yet. Me, I'd never have thought of that.
Cal, I found... I think I see the dragon!
What?
The dragon! I think it's dead! Oh, it's dead, Cal! It's got licked in a fight! All those scales! Oh, we're rich, Cal! Come on up and...
Don't! Come away from there!
Cal! Cal, he's going to get me! Cal, he's going to get me! He's climbing up! Cal, he's climbing!
Kelvin of Rudd, Book 1, Dragon's Gold.
Available now in graphic audio.
You just cannot stay out of trouble for any time at all, can you, boy?
Preacher! You sure have good timing.
I always have. Might have showed up a few minutes earlier, though, since you only left one of the varmints for me to kill.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Family Jensen, Number 3, The Violent Land.
Preacher, it is so good to see you again.
Well, it is mighty good to be here.
I'm glad the two of you were able to make it here today. I have a big supper planned.
Well, you two are flapping your gums. That varmint was about to shoot Preacher in the back.
Oh, no, he wouldn't, Matt. I figured you'd take care of him.
What if I hadn't been paying attention?
Well, I knew you would be. Smoke and meat taught you well enough.
Where'd you say you were from?
Germany. Prussia, to be precise.
What's this about a wagon train?
Baron Friedrich von Hoffmann is our leader. He's taking a large group of settlers to the American states called Wyoming. The Baron has bought a ranch there and intends to establish a town as well.
Sounds like a fellow with big plans. Oh, hell!
We gotta do something, Smoke. The Baron's had guards posted, but they won't be expecting something like that.
That's why you've got to get around them and warn everybody at the Raptor 9. Your horse is just as fast as mine or Preacher's, and you can organize a defense. There's no time to waste.
What about the two of you?
We're going to follow them. When they attack the ranch, we'll hit them where they least expect it. From behind.
Damn right we will. We'll have those varmints in a trap right where we want them.
It can't be.
I'm about to ride up there and see for myself. Want me to have the boys saddle a horse for you so you can come along with me?
Damned right I do. I want to see this with my own eyes.
It'll mean going onto that foreigner's range.
I don't give a damn about that. Pick out a dozen men to ride with us and tell them to be ready to fight.
Come on, Bat! We'll cover you!
Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.